Hello and welcome to What a Scream, the horror movie podcast where I, your host, Egrain, chats with a special guest every week about horror films. And we talk about two films in particular that have to do with a certain subject that I've previously randomly chosen. Now this week, the subject is torture porn, that genre that kind of came to prominence the early 2000s. It's a very interesting genre, I think, especially because when we look at what was going on at the time in society and how this, you know, horror films always reflect society, but I just think it's a really interesting time within horror history and how that is reflected in what was popular at the time. So yes, my guest this week is Kanel from Kanel's Sinister Cinema, and together we are talking about two torture porn films. Now the first one is 2005's The Devil's Rejects, directed by Rob Zombie, which was the sequel to his House of a Thousand Corpses. And we are also talking about The Collector from 2009, directed by Marcus Dunstan. So enjoy our little chat about torture porn. So I would like to welcome to What a Scream, Kanel. How are you?
Hey, safe, how are we?
Ah, yeah, I'm grand. Coming off the back of, well, this is five out of six podcast recordings that I'm doing today. So, yeah.
Jeez. hectic day.
Yeah. Sure, look, listen, it has to be done. So would you like to introduce yourself and tell listeners who you are and what you do?
Hey, safe. I'm Kanel. I am a battle rapper for Don't Flop and various other leagues. I'm also a podcaster. Check out my podcast on YouTube and or your favorite audio platform of choice, Kanel's Sinister Cinema. And doing a bit of Twitch streaming lately. So follow me on twitch.tv/Kanelio, where I play loads of horror games and stuff.
Cool. So how did you get into horror? And do you remember what the first horror film was you ever saw?
I was always into spooky stuff, like, you know, always like, you know, like, you know, like a lot of us are, you can trace it back to, like, you know, the ghosty episodes of Scooby-Doo and all that kind of thing. I was always into that. And I'd seen some things which I now describe as horror, but, you know, I maybe wouldn't have looked at them in that way, like Jaws for. But the big flipping flashpoint, key triggering event, like, holy shit, was the 1992 broadcast of Ghost Watch.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. Were you one of those people that saw it when it came out and you were like, is this real? What is going on?
Yeah, I was 12. I was 12, there's a lot of flipping, like, strange takes on that. Like, people say, like, oh, but it was, like, listed in the TV guide. What people don't remember is, like, TV guides were for posh people, man. But we didn't have a TV guide. Yeah. Back in them days, we had four channels. Mm-hmm. And, like, it was there was the TV Times did ITV and Channel 4. And the Radio Times did BBC One and BBC Two. You had to get two magazines if you wanted to have all the information what was on there. Yeah. And, like, most people couldn't afford one. It was ridiculous, like, buying a TV guide that didn't even have all the TV in. So it was just like there was this vague awareness that there was a thing going to be on, and Craig Charles was going to be in it. Like, I liked a bit of Red Dwarf, and Sarah Green was in it. And, like, obviously, you know, that was where I watched my Saturday morning cartoons going live and all this kind of thing. So I watched it, like, believing it was a live broadcast for most of it, like.
And did it really freak you out?
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah. That was the first, like, oh my God, what is happening? And at the end, it's a bit silly and you realize, oh, this is a bit daft, but, you know, that. And then there was the whole thing, like, they had to, like, be on Saturday morning TV saying, no, we're not dead. It's cool. We're alive. And you settle down like that. But then you get to school on Monday and everyone's talking in the playground. And that's where the urban legends start going around and all this, like, you know, so I was kind of like, for most of the running time, I thought it was real. And flipping that scared me in a way that I've just been chasing ever since.
Yeah, I didn't see it when it first came out because I was three. But like a couple of years ago, I went and watched it. And I still think it's as effective as it would have been when it first went out on live TV.
Yeah, flipping. I might watch it later, actually. I only bought the Blu-ray like yesterday.
Yeah.
So I've got it in my little ready to go section there.
Yeah. Like. Nice, nice. Yeah, Pipes freaks me out. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
Okay, so the topic for this episode is torture porn, which is it's kind of quite a divisive subgenre, I think. What is your opinion on torture porn?
I was like the perfect age for like most of these torture porn films when they started dropping, because it's going off like the sort of early to mid 2000s. And something about that time, like I feel it was like kicking back against a lot of things, like because round about then, you know, we're coming to the end of the sort of post Scream wave, all this kind of thing, and like flipping, I love Scream so much, but in the things after it, like Hollywood was trying to like sort of recreate the success, and you know, it's we put Dawson's Creek people in the horror movie, and what should we call it? We try and get it like lower rating, so we don't have no nudity in it, and we maybe the kills aren't so gnarly and that, so we could sell it to teenagers. But meanwhile, the teenagers, the young people at the time, they're discovering the internet. And like flipping, the internet at that time was the Wild West. It was crazy out there. And, you know, we were all, there was only about like five websites, and one of them was rotten.com and all this kind of thing. So at the same time, like the young people that they're trying to sell the like Dawson's Creek, no sex, no violence, flipping slasher movies to, are watching like cartel beheadings.
Yeah.
And stuff like, so there's this real sort of disconnect between like what's happening in the horror films, and like, you know, younger people are seeing like more graphic violence than ever before. So and I think like people who are like into horror kind of getting a bit sick of like, you know, I don't need all these like Dawson's Creek people in my horror films. I want something a bit more gnarly again. And there's a few things that are sort of like, I think like an early forerunner of it was Strangeland, which was Dee Snider's one. Didn't really have like the sort of gnarliness, but it had a lot of
getting there
aesthetics that carry through to in the torture porn genre. And I'd say the remake of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where they sort of rebooted it, and it's a very good film. It's like really gritty and gnarly, like, and flipping still stands up.
Yeah.
And then we get onto your Saws and your Hostels and all these kind of things, and like these films were like it shouldn't be understated that these films were very big hits in the cinema, like, you know, like because I mean, like, I picked the film I picked because there's some parallels with grindhouse cinema. But whereas with grindhouse cinema, like in that early exploitation stuff, the reason it's called exploitation is because they're these people with these like small budgets, they're trying to make a film that's like saying something and doing something that Hollywood won't, and that'll be their selling point. They're going to exploit their selling point. We're going to show you some shit that you won't see from a Hollywood film. But these films, a lot of them were like mega successful hits. You were seeing in your local Odeons and flipping whatever the equivalent of you was at the time.
Yeah.
And it captures a very interesting period of time for my respect. Like, a lot of these films, like, you know, I got like quite close attachment to them from growing up with them. But also one thing I've been noticed, because like big on collecting me discs, you know, Blu-rays, I'm onto the 4Ks now and all this. What I'm finding is like something about the films of this era, in the same way that you get like these weird old sort of like VHS nerds that are like, say, oh, you should only watch that on video. It's the only real way to watch it. All this kind of thing. I'm finding something about some of these torture porn films that they just look, that they just feel a bit nicer on my old school crusty DVD. to the what should we call it, like the super clean up print. I've got there's something about like because I think it's from that time of early internet and low bandwidth that, you know, 480p layout like kind of suits, like.
Yeah, definitely. Like when they all started coming out, we were in a really weird time in history where we had obviously the internet was mad. No one quite knew how to navigate it, and we all stumbled on weird things. But it was also a time at which we had a lot of stuff like 9/11 happen, and this kind of before something like that wasn't reported on, wasn't shown on the internet as soon as, but now we were in this day where we were being shown these type of horrific things happening on the news. And so it was almost like mainstream audiences were becoming desensitized to horror because we were seeing a lot of it on the internet, on the news. And so it got to the point where filmmakers were like, well, now we really have to push audiences a little bit more towards the extreme. And this is where torture porn came out of, and kind of this general cultural feeling of anger and rage towards other people. Say, like in Hostel, it's this rage and anger towards foreign lands. And yeah, it was just a really strange time. And I, as much as torture porn gets a bit of a graft, you know, it was very badly panned with critics. I actually
Yeah,
quite
I mean,
enjoy
like the
it.
name itself is an insult, really, isn't it? It's something like a critic made to slander this new movement,
But
but it was
I quite have a
embraced.
soft spot for it. I think it's they're great films to put on if you want something a little bit more gutsy, but you're not quite going towards the guinea pig
Yeah, I
kind of
mean,
thing.
like. Films like Guinea Pig, what should we call it? They are actually like the pornography of torture. That's, you know, if you want something that was accurately described as torture porn, you would be looking at something like the Guinea Pig series. But whereas these films, you know, it was just a slanderous term, like, but you know, and there's one thing, and the films around this time, they're like very, very stylized because you know, a lot of them are very green for some reason, and you know, it's this kind of look. They're all like, you know, it's because like directors have come up on Evil Dead 2 and Nine Inch Nails videos of Marilyn Manson, and it's nu metal and like all this kind of thing. So it's very stylized. So like, whilst there is some very gnarly stuff here, it's not like an August Underground where it's like, oh, this could be real. They are very much movies, like, so you can enjoy the ride a bit more than you can with that like extreme content where it looks fucking real.
Okay, so let's start off with your choice of film. Would you like to introduce it and give a synopsis, please?
Yeah, it's The Devil's Rejects by Mr. Robert Zombie.
What police have uncovered reads like this. Words can't describe it.
We here, we are playing on a level that most will never see. You're gonna start the killing. You best start it right here.
This film is the follow-up to House of a Thousand Corpses, which was his film that he did earlier. It came out in a very different time. Like, I don't know if you know the background to House of a Thousand Corpses, but basically Universal commissioned Rob Zombie to make like a ride for their Halloween Horror Nights, like a spook show haunt attraction. And he pitched their thing, and they said that, wow, well, that's really good. Would you like to pitch a movie? And he pitched the ride again. And that's what House of the Thousand Corpses is. It's the ride he was going to do, effectively. And it's like a really crazy film because he's doing all these like you know, he's trying to use every film format he can. It's like flipping. It's like you've had a, like you've got one opportunity to make a movie, and he directed all the White Zombie videos.
Yeah,
you've got one opportunity to make a movie, so you're throwing everything you can in here in case you'll never get another go.
Yeah,
and that was like, you know, I think it was like the mid to late 90s that was coming together. It took ages to be released. I remember, like, if you went to see, like, he was touring mainly solo. It was round about the times your Dracula and your Super Beast and all that, the kind of thing. And like he'd be showing, like, the trailer for this House of a Thousand Corpses, like, in his concerts, but it was ages till it actually came out. And had a very troubled history. But eventually we get round to the point that it comes out, it's got a bit of success, and they make The Devil's Rejects. And this time he's actually thought about it a bit more. He's tried to like make more of, you know, a constructed movie, a constructed narrative. And it's calling back to a lot of the Grindhouse era of stuff, like things like your Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And like even things like the Wild Bunch and all that kind of thing, and to a greater degree, which I don't think gets acknowledged, because I think a lot of people don't want to admit that they've seen it, is it takes a lot from Fight for Your Life, and it's the continuing story of the Firefly family, who are the antagonists in House of a Thousand Corpses. In this, they're the kind of like villainous protagonists. We're sort of following them as the, what should we call it, a sheriff who is the brother of the sheriff they killed in the first one, is trying to track them down and fuck their shit up.
So I was that typical teenager who loved Rob Zombie films as a kid. House of a Thousand Corpses was the right level of kind of camp grotesqueness, and it was lots of very bright colors, which I absolutely loved. And like you said, it's a ride in movie format. And so then The Devil's Rejects came out, and it's completely the opposite. Basically, it's not as colorful, like you said before. It's like 70s Grindhouse. It's got that kind of colorization to it. It's very, you know, shot in the desert. Even the costuming is quite 70s. And the thing I loved about The Devil's Rejects was how our kind of view was skewed. So in the first one, it's very much, you know, they're terrible torturers. They're like evil. And in this one, it gives them humanization, which is really strange because they're still serial killers. But somehow you are rooting for them despite the terrible things they do. What do you think was the point of that from Rob Zombie's perspective?
It should be said, like, what's it called? We're sort of on side with these because, you know, like Baby and Captain Spaulding and that, they're like kind of funny characters in a way. Like, what should we call it? Like, pretty much everyone in this film is pretty detestable in some way. And the fact is, the main guy, the sheriff, the cop, he is just a cunt, just out for vengeance. And he's earned, like, you know, I'm not what you'd call a pro police person at the best of times, like, but, you know. So, you know, but this isn't just anti-cop. This is like one particular bad guy who is abusing his, you know, it's like no other crimes are getting solved, like flipping. Like, if you're doing anything, like, it's a great time to be committing crime in this area of his jurisdiction, because no one's doing anything else. They're all after the Firefly family.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, when I was watching it, so I haven't seen it since for a good few years now. And obviously I've seen a lot more things, and kind of my tastes have, I'd hope, matured. But looking back, I was kind of like, is my, like, distaste for authority and my hatred for police so strong that I'm like, oh man, I hope the Firefly, like, I hope they kill them all. It's just, yeah, it's so, I just love how he skewed kind of this perception of good and bad, and kind of like, there is no good and bad, it's only kind of gray area, basically. Now, one of the scenes that probably gets the most controversy is definitely the motel scene. It's so well done, but it's so horrific at the same time. What do you think of that whole sequence?
It is horrendous and nightmarish and very grounded in reality. Like, the whole thing about it. And this is like where I think the Fight for Your Life influence comes in. Like, are you familiar with Fight for Your Life?
No, I'm not. So I'm definitely going to have to go back and
right.
check that out.
This is a film from the 1970s. And this is one thing that I think is really interesting.
Yeah.
Because I've got a bit of a take that I'm going to get to at the end of Fight for Your Life. Like, Fight for Your Life is the only film that was added to the UK Video Nasties list because of language.
Okay.
Yeah. What's it called? It was this very nasty sort of a subgenre of like exploitation films called race baiting.
Okay.
And what it is, it concerns like these three guys who escaped from prison. There's a white guy. I think a Mexican guy and an Asian guy, and they're sort of on the run and they take a black family hostage.
Mm.
And, it's a revenge film.
Okay.
And like, the white guy's the ringleader and flipping the it's really hard to watch because of the language. It's not just the flipping regular racial slurs. He's using shit that they haven't used since fucking... I imagine the people who used them also wore monocles and all this kind of thing. These kind of like antique Victorian, like fucking like racial slurs and the very, he's cast a lot of, he's talking through a lot of like racist tropes while he's abusing this family. They got him control, but eventually the family get the better of him. And it's a revenge plot like that, you know, it's sort of like a race revenge rather than rape revenge. And the thing about this is like how they marketed the film is like, it's called Fight for Your Life. This is the version that most people are familiar with. But what they also did was they edited a different trailer and put it out as Staying Alive. Yeah. And the trailer for Staying Alive focused mainly on the, the revenge at the end. And the, the trailer for Fight for Your Life was focused mainly on, the racism and the abuse and the torture, like. And they, like, they play the different trailers and, like, run the film under different titles in different demographic areas.
Yeah.
So, like, predominantly like black areas, but like primarily black cinemas, they'd be playing the Staying Alive trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this trailer for this film about this black family like doing over these racists.
Mm.
And meanwhile, they're playing like the very racist trailer for like Fight for Your Life in like, you know, more like white flipping redneck areas.
Okay.
And they think it was a film about, just on a rampage kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like.
Oh, interesting. And,
it's a very difficult film to watch. Yeah. Like. But, do you have any idea how racist you've got to be made illegal in 1980s Britain?
Yeah, yeah.
Back when they were still using the N-word on the young ones at 7 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, is it? But what should we call it? Like I feel like the sort of whole hostage section of that in Fight for Your Life is a very big influence on this motel scene.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously it's all white people in the motel scene. You know, it's the folk band called Banjo and whatever.
Yeah.
So he's taken a lot from it. But my take is this the only good example of whitewashing in a remake?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Because it's still like a horrendous thing to watch, like, but
yeah,
it would be unwatchable like if there was a racial element in there, like.
Yeah, exactly. And it kind of, you kind of hope that perhaps one of them will get away, and then your hopes are completely dashed by what it culminates in, which is the poor girl gets squished by a lorry after she's wearing her father as a skin mask, which is kind of, I guess,
such a wild sequence like that, because a bit of time's passed from the main motel sequence, but it's the cleaner coming round and then she comes around with the mask. It's like that bit reminds me of a lot of Texas Chainsaw Massacre when they open the fridge and
all this, exactly, like. Yeah.
Oh, I forgot this is an audio podcast. I did the wiggle of someone like coming out, jumping out of a freezer in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It doesn't work so well in the audio medium, but you know which bit I'm talking about.
Exactly, exactly. So what do you think, if there was anything, what do you think Rob Zombie was kind of saying with this film? Do you think there's any subtext with it?
To be honest, I don't think he went that deep with it.
You're like, no.
Yeah,
no depth,
I mean,
no depth,
like he's gone deep by Rob Zombie standards for having a plot line. Because before this, he's done White Zombie videos, which are just like the craziest visuals, like. And then he'd done that with a film. This time he's actually done a film with a plot. It's kind of like a Bonnie and Clyde kind of escaping across the desert kind of thing with this cop on the trail, you know, taking an influence from everything from like Smokey and the Bandit, the Wild Bunch, all these kind of things, like. And the aesthetic kind of comes from them, but because of when it was filmed and like how we were making films around the time, you know, it just sits right next to like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre reboot and this kind of thing, you know. It feels very mid-2000s, like, even though he was going for it. I think the only thing that really, like, separates it is the soundtrack.
And I will say it is the greatest use of Freebird in an ending sequence. For a while, it was, like, the only song I'd listened to. So would you recommend The Devil's Rejects to horror fans?
I would recommend it to certain horror fans.
Yeah.
It's not a film I do. If someone says, recommend me a horror film, I'm not going to hit that first. But if I know what kind of films you're into, I'll have a pretty good idea if it's worth recommending Devil's Rejects for you. It's one of them.
Yeah. I'd recommend it kind of along the lines if someone was like, oh, I'm going to watch House of a Thousand Corpses. I'd be like, you know what? Watch The Devil's Rejects afterwards just to see this weird flip in where our alliances kind of fall. It's a very strange duo. Like a strange sequel to an original film because they're both very different in their aesthetic. But how and ever, I cannot remember anything about Three from Hell, if I'm being completely honest. I cannot remember a thing
just,
from it.
It just kind of sucked, like, and
it's just bad. It's that's
one of those, like, I felt like all the criticism that what should we call it goes at, like, Rob Zombie, and some of it's very unnecessary. Like, I think all of it is valid in Three from Hell.
Mm-hmm.
And like Sherry Moon Zombie gets a horrendous amount of flipping stick online. And I don't think a lot of that's fair ages. Like, everyone's like, oh, she's a terrible actor. For one thing, I do not believe for a second that she is delivering anything other than exactly the performance she was asked to do by the director. And I haven't seen her in anything other than Rob Zombie stuff. So you can't really call her bad if she's done what she was supposed to do well, can you?
That's very true.
Admittedly, like, he's gone shit at the end, but before he went shit, like, what's call it, Tim Burton, like, no one slags flipping the constant Helena Bonham Carter appearances off.
I would. I did.
Yeah. Like, one thing, but she doesn't get anywhere near the hate of Sherry.
Oh, God, no. Zombie. No, not at all. Not at all.
Like, Ariel from Ghouls Mag, I had her on my podcast, and we had a bit of a conversation about torture porn. And one thing I brought up then is, like, around this era, I've got this idea that sometimes there's the guy, and it's easier to hate the guy when you know what he looks like. Like, you remember that Martin Shkreli guy? He's the farmer bro. He bought the rights to this, certain AIDS medication and inflated the price massively.
Mm-hmm.
And whilst that is horrendous, it's also what his industry does.
Yeah.
Like, particularly in America where all healthcare is strictly privatized and all this, all the big pharmacological companies do them, but we don't know what them guys look like. You know, it's just boardrooms. Flipping the guy who runs Pfizer could walk past you in the street. You'd have no idea because we knew what this guy looked like. Because he was making public appearances, being on social media and looking like a little Weasley prick. All the hatred that goes towards him And what happens in the torture porn era is, I think, primarily Rob Zombie, because we already knew about him already, and we knew who he was and what he looked like. And Eli Roth, who like sort of went under the wing of Quentin Tarantino, was like we knew what these directors looked like, you know, like normal people would know what they look like, but a normal person doesn't necessarily know what James Wan looks like.
Yeah.
So they're kind of like celebrities in this way. And at that point, they're the guy. So there's people who do what Rob Zombie does in movies a lot worse, executes a lot worse. And there is some valid criticisms of it. I think he's a good director, not so good a writer, pretty terrible with dialogue. Although Devil's Rejects is good because some of the characters have some absolute bars in it.
Okay, so let's move on to my choice of film, which I thought I'd seen before, and then when I watched it I was like, no, this wasn't the film that I'd see. Anywho, I chose The Collector from 2009, written by Patrick Melton and Marcus Dunstan, and directed by Marcus Dunstan.
I run a smooth operation out here. I pick the jobs, you pick the locks, we pick up the prize together. That's a routine. You need me to think about that woman of yours and that little pretty girl of yours. Now you've been casing that family's house for months. You think the family is going out of town. You found the safe. Now, what was that request of yours?
We sell tonight.
Originally, it was a spin-off, a prequel to Saw, but the execs turned them down. And it was meant to be an origin story for John Kramer, which I find quite interesting. It is set on this guy. He's been brought in as a handyman around this house, and it turns out that he's actually casing the joint, and he is going to rob it to try and pay back some loan sharks that his girlfriend has got into. And he breaks into this house and he assumes the family have gone on a holiday. But when he gets there, he realizes the whole house has been made into a massive trap and the family have actually been taken hostage by this guy called the Collector, who collects people, basically. And the whole house is basically one big Saw trap. What do you think of the Collector?
This is a gnarly one, this. This is very interesting. It's a good one to sort of illustrate the transition between like the post-Scream slasher. Because in a lot of ways, it is a slasher film. But it's got that aesthetic and it's got the torture porn levels of gnarliness. And it's crazy. It's some of the stuff in this is absolutely horrific. What I find quite interesting about it is how many of the traps are also traps from Home Alone.
You're right. Oh, my God. You're the absolutely
flipping,
right.
The spikes on the stairs, the flipping glue traps, the flipping, like, swingy thing. There's a lot of the exact same traps in there.
Now but we know what happened to Kevin McAllister when he grew up. He became the Collector.
I mean, like, flipping.
You've sold it, Canal. You've sold it.
This is like the back end. Flipping Macaulay Culkin's my age, and this was sort of like about 2008 or something, was it?
2009, yeah.
2009. So, Kevin McAllister's 29 at that point. that he could be the Collector.
Yeah. Oh my God. That's
and we
amazing.
Don't know he isn't.
Yeah. You've solved it.
Yeah.
I was not expecting much from this. And then it's so funny because, like, from even the title sequence, it reminded me of Seven a lot.
Yeah.
The title, so it had that
very strong aesthetic, and it was basically Saw. And then when I read that it was meant to be a prequel to Saw, I was like, that makes so much more sense. But yeah, there was just so many times in this film where I actually physically winced, and that takes a lot for me to do that. And you know what? It's all because it's very relatable violence, like stepping on a nail. Or the most horrific one for me was the glue one, like you said. And I think that's mainly because the cat was trapped in it. And
context of when I rewatched it, like, because I've watched it a few times. I enjoyed it more on this watch than I normally do. I think sometimes I just feel it's too familiar and I kind of like tune out of it, or like it's something I put up watch while I'm drunk or while I was high, and I watched it like completely sober. Because my cat Dillinger had been in the vets for an operation the day before, and he's getting what should we call it? You know, he's got all these stitches in him, and it's been a thing that's been going on for a while, and flipping. I didn't know if he was going to be all right, and things weren't as bad as they thought they were. But I've spent like my last month, like, in a very bad emotional state because I'm worried about my cat, and also completely skint because I've dropped well over a grand on vets in the last 5 weeks. And like, so seeing that bit, I was like, oh my God, it was just like Dillinger.
Yeah. Horrific moment.
Yeah.
So this wasn't like a massive hit. I mean, it's become a bit of a cult underground thing, I think, at the moment, but it wasn't massive. Do you think that by this time, so this was 2009, do you think that it was kind of coming out on the tail end of the torture porn genre, and perhaps audiences had already become desensitized to the kind of shock that we saw with Saw? Do you think it kind of came out at the wrong time? It would have been better if it came out a little bit earlier.
I don't know if desensitized was a term, because I don't think audiences were bored by this if they saw it, because like flipping, no matter how familiar with the torture porn genre and like every film in it are, this has some of the gnarliest sequences in it. Like shit, you can really feel like.
Yeah.
You know, it plays with all the hits, all the things that you can really feel like. And again, like all that Home Alone shit, it's wild how many Home Alone tracks. Sorry, I'm bringing it up again, but it's insane.
It's true. That's so funny. I need to go back and rewatch it now just for that. Do you think it was saying anything about class? Because these families that were getting kind of elected, they're all quite upper class, whereas our main character Arkin he's obviously of a working class. Do you think he had anything to say about that?
I think that's how we establish how villainous the the collector is, because you know, if it was just a film about the people who lived in the house, I don't think we'd have that connection. It'd just be like a guy who's like, fuck the rich and that. As soon as you're fucking up with someone who's like, you know, just an electrician or something, who's like in a lot of trouble, in debts, like, you know, he's very much doing this against his will. He's got to deal with these loan sharks. As soon as you get to deal with that, you realize that the collector is just a completely fucking psychotic villain, and it's not about class and all this. That's why I struggle getting the class take on it, because Evolution of Horror are doing their home invasion series at the minute, and like there's a lot in that about how you know, a lot of those films are quite class-based. It's like, even from things like People Under the Stairs or something, the have-nots.
Yeah, Funny Games,
It's the have-nots getting into the room of the haves.
Yeah.
And in this one, the fucking have-nots, like, break into the haves against their will, and there's a psychotic fucking serial killer there doing fucking crazy fucking Home Alone shit.
So what do you think about the collector never really being revealed? Do you think that makes for a better villain, or would you have liked kind of this big reveal about who he is and why he's doing it?
I think it makes for a scarier villain. I mean, all we know is this guy is very, very good at what he does. Like, you know, he's doing crazy, he's doing these Like you know, like flipping this, and it must have been something that he's been doing for a very long time. You don't like, because there's lots of times when the character will try and like second guess his trap, and he's got a backup plan. Yeah. You don't have those kind of backup plans, like, unless you have experience in that field. So this guy, the collector, has been doing this a very, very long time. Like, you know, he's a. This is something that's been ongoing, and like, you know, so just the fact that he's that experienced, that tooled up, that he knows that he can do all this mad stuff and like really like put people into corners and think that far ahead of them, like flipping supervillain levels ahead, because he is a supervillain, isn't he? Like, you know, it's like James Bond will get out of the trap, but the collector's like ahead of the Bond villains, because he'll have a backup plan for the trap, for when the trap doesn't work, or maybe the trap's not meant to work. And it's and like to have someone who's this much of an evil genius, like a H.H. Holmes, but in your own house. Like, I think it's a, like, what story do you have to explain that, like, you know, that doesn't take something away from it? Like, you know, I think he needs to be this unknown quantity, and it does make it more terrifying.
Yeah. Also leaves it open for the sequel, which it does, which I think I might go and watch as well. I want to know how long it took him to set up all these very elaborate traps, because between, you know, Ark and finishing work and then going back to the house, it's not a lot of time. So I need to know, like, is the collector like superhuman in the way that he can go set up all these mad elaborate traps, Macaulay Culkin style, or what's going on? Because it's taken him ages to do all that. So at what point? Like, maybe that's me being too picky about, like...
Well, this is it. If you know exactly where everything goes in advance, like, you think of all the, like, that was kind of interesting, because if you think of all the work that you had to do in the house to just know where the safe is, then, like, flipping, you know, the collector must have been observing for months, like, had all this shit nearby, ready to go, flipping, like, you know, just like a high-speed flipping loadout. This goes there, this goes there, this goes there. There's been observation there. There's been, you know, whole other degrees of stalking and casing the joint.
I mean,
it's completely preposterous, but that's the only way it could be done. So, like, then you kind of get a picture of it, like...
Yeah, it definitely adds a whole new layer of like creepiness to it, that it's not just like this home invasion. It's basically like this planned home invasion that involves stalking. And, you know, it's quite opposite to perhaps like The Strangers or Them, where they're like, you were in the right place at the wrong time and we just picked you because you were home. This is basically like he is going into some serious organization and planning skills here.
Most of that has gone into place after he's got the, because, you know, flipping, we know from those other kind of films that just run up in a gaff and flipping take people out one by one, flipping Night Stalker style. You don't need those traps to do that. He's taken them, he's kidnapped them and then put the traps up. And like he's like ready for the police and all this, like, so maybe it's that, maybe he was after the police, like.
So would you recommend The Collector to horror fans?
Previously, off the back of this watch, I would recommend it, Flipping, you know, if you just want something new metal and back, flipping, very good soundtrack. It's got all, like, loads of industrial shit on there, like a German band that I can't pronounce the name of, like, but I remember they were big around the time of Nine Inch Nails when I was into all that, like, so... I think if you just want to watch something that's straight up gnarly and you're ready to deal with a cat being a bit stressed out at one point, because that is the hardest bit for me. Like,
that is, same as a cat person, as a cat owner. I would recommend it. I think it's perfect for, you know, these kind of casual, I'm not saying this in a derogatory way, but, you know, like casual horror fans that are like, you know, if you sat them down in front of something from Ari Aster, they'd be like, oh, I don't get it, it wasn't scary enough. You know, I'm thinking about this from my husband's point of view, because he's very much like, he likes things to be quite you know, it's quite straightforward.
Yeah.
And so I would definitely recommend it to someone like him who, you know, wants a horror film, but to be quite gnarled out by it, but doesn't quite want to watch August Underground or like wouldn't join me in watching those kind of films. So yeah, I'd recommend that for someone like him.
Recommend it for a Christmas double billing with Home Alone. I think that's a very
good call.
I might try and program that, you know, I've been looking into doing like small screenings around Chester.
Yeah, do it.
I've got the idea for the first theme. That'd be a good one for Christmas. Home Alone, back to back, The Collector.
The most unlikely seasonal festive holiday film that you're ever likely to come across. I love it. So out of the two films, if someone was like, I want to watch torture porn film tonight and I've only got these two films, which one would you choose over the other?
It's a tough one. If someone just casually wants to watch some torture porn, I'd say it's The Collector.
Yeah.
But people are kind of like fitting the profile of a Rob Zombie fan. They're getting a Devil's Rejects.
Yeah, I'd go with, you know what? It's kind of difficult because you're like, okay, Rob Zombie, along with Eli Roth and James Wan, was kind of one of the definitive directors of this era in horror. So I'd be like, okay, you know, Devil's Rejects. It's kind of a little bit of like horror history. But I think if you wanted a definitive aesthetic, content, like what was torture porn, I definitely go for The Collector, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's definitely two different questions. If someone asks, what should I watch if I'm getting into torture porn, or I want to watch a torture porn film?
Yeah.
I think the two things are two answers for two separate questions there, Defo.
Exactly. Now, do you think there's a future in torture porn? We've seen a lot of, I'm just thinking of even like the most recent Evil Dead rise is very graphic. It's very gory. It's very relatable violence that does make you go, ooh. But do you think there's much of a future for the torture porn genre? Do you think there's going to be, as we've all seen, trends in horror come back around? Do you think it's going to come back around, and in what capacity?
Well, I don't see it anytime soon, because I think any kind of like a movement like that has got to be kicking against something, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like all these curious young minds discovering all this like insane real life violence on the internet, and they're seeing this muted stuff in horror. Something had to kick against that. I'd say like, you know, the next movement, it's not going to be torture porn. It's going to be like, you know, horror movies for shaggers, really, because that's what we're not getting, is we're not getting like the horniness in films as much. And
Going against those Puritan Gen Zers.
Yeah. And well, this is it. Like, I think like, because a lot of it's like, I don't know many people like that I actually know who like think like, yeah, we need less sex in movies. Like, I think it is like, because like, you know, we've got this whole generation of people that it's the first kind of generation where like, if you sort of grew up like watching superhero movies or Disney or whatever, you don't have to grow out of it and you can just watch that forever. But if you're not even watching movies with the word fuck in it, things are going to seem too extreme for you. And then these are the people that are then coming on the internet and saying, bro, this shouldn't happen. But they're not the market. So, you know, I think, you know, and, you know, also, like, you know, flipping, it's not like years ago when, like, you know, you're going to sell more tickets if you put, like, nudity or sex in a film because people have access to pornography. But that means that, flipping, anyone who is putting, sex, nudity, for, these themes in a movie, you know, is actually trying to tell a story about that. And some people want to hear stories about that because it reflects their, you know, real life existence. So I think like it, shaggers horror is going to be the next one. And it won't officially like be called a movement till someone like comes up with a better term than it. Shaggers horror is the best one I've got. But it'll be like some like clever fucking film critic will come up with something, probably insulting it. And the first, and like, looking back, they'll say the first films in the movement were films like Titan and Infinity Pool and all that kind of thing.
I was just about to say, the Cronenbergs are definitely coming through with glimmers of the beginnings of that, definitely. So thank you so much for coming on and chatting about torture porn. Now, before we go, I always ask my guests, what is your favorite horror film?
Favorite horror film? I bounce between Evil Dead 2, but recently I've been more leaning on The Thing. It's okay. A bait answer that probably everyone gives, but it's that good.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's only been one other person that said The Thing as their favorite horror film. But yeah. But you know what? You know, it's actually one of the very few sci-fi films I actually quite like. I wouldn't be a massive fan of sci-fi. Evil Dead 2. I'm really surprised that everyone always goes for Evil Dead 2 and not Evil Dead, because that's like the Evil Dead is one of my favorite, just because of how much of an example of like micro budget filmmaking it was, and still how absolute brilliant it is. Like
I think it's because like with Evil Dead 2 had like the big reaction on me as a kid. I was like, whoa, this is incredible. Why isn't every film like this?
Yeah.
But like flipping the Evil Dead, which I just got on 4K.
Yeah.
At the minute, if you go to HMV, you know, they have the things at the counter, like ready purchase. The 4K Evil Dead is like a tenner with any purchase. So I grabbed one of them last week. I got them already on Blu-ray, but I'll have it's one of those ones that I'll always buy the upgrade. And like flipping, it's amazing how well, like what they've done with just like, you know, Steadicam hasn't been invented yet. We'll tape it to a flipping plank and we'll run and all this, like.
Yeah.
You know, it's incredible stuff.
It is. So I know you said it at the beginning, but just remind people where they can find you on social media.
Okay, on my socials, I am at KinelSC on your Twitter. There's the Sinister_Cinema Twitter, but I don't update that so much. You're better off catching my personal one. Follow me on Twitch, because I'm trying to get that popping, and I'm doing that and playing horror games every night. I'm playing Blair Witch Project at the minute. Just finished Ghostwire Tokyo. I find try and like get J horror games if I can get them, because they scare the shit out of me. people like that on a stream. My podcast is Kinel Sinister Cinema. We got a Patreon if you want to get on board with a bit of that. My podcast isn't like a clever one like this, because I'm a thick guest. So like sometimes I get cool people talking intelligent things about films. Sometimes it's just my mates from the world of battle rap and rap in general, and we just talk shit. And nice. About movies, but we do just talk shit.
So that was my chat there with Kinel about the horror subgenre torture porn, and we talked about 2005's The Devil's Rejects, as well as 2009's The Collector. So let me know what you think of this week's topic. Do you like torture porn? What do you think of it looking back now retrospectively? Let me know on Instagram and Twitter, @what_scream on Twitter and @whatascream on Instagram. And don't forget to review, subscribe, rate on whatever podcast platform you are listening to me on. And don't forget to stay horrific. Goodbye.